Let's see if we can just decide when the prophets lived, instead of reading verse by verse the rest of that. Since the book of Lamentations begins with the spirit of grief because the temple is smoldering in ashes, what do you think about that? When would that have happened?
After Judean was captured. During the captivity.
During the captivity covers a period of 70 years.
I felt like it was from the time that Jordan and them come down.
Can you hear that? Can you hear Jimmy?
I felt like it was from the time Nebuchadnezzar and the captain of Nebuchadnezzar come down and tore all the walls down and burned the city. But I also felt like it run into when Jeremiah was kind of left behind and he seen everybody wagging their heads and hissing and everything as they went by. And I think it was really just disgraceful, just terrible feeling to see the heathens and everybody else going by to pull down the city and that when he stayed behind there after they took the rest of them captive. And had to see them all just kissing and just shaming. Just like it said in Deuteronomy.
Well, it seems obvious that the time for Lamentations is immediately after Jerusalem is destroyed. You can't say after the captivity because now is after the captivity. That's from the captivity on till present day and into the future.
I was talking about when it happened.
Yeah, but when you have it on your paper, after the captivity, I don't know what you got in your head. Soon after is good.
The first words in Lamentation say, how doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? So it's kind of like, to me, everybody's gone and he wasn't taken and he's sitting there and the city's just destroyed and he's lamenting.
Yeah, the people are gone out of Jerusalem. So if the people are gone out of Jerusalem, it has to be after the Babylonians have destroyed the city. The temple's destroyed, everything.
It seems to me it would have been within the first year or two after Jerusalem was sacked.
Maybe the first weeks.
Soon after.
Yeah. It's difficult to believe he would have prophesied this 50 years after. The feelings would have been dulled after a while, I would think.
How empty would Jerusalem have been, say, 5 years after?
There would have been nothing there.
Well, I mean, you had the Edomites. They sound like they were kind of coming in.
Yeah, but the city was all burned, destroyed. The walls, the king's palace, the temple, the city was plundered and burned. It wasn't anything there to live in much. Maybe some shepherds kept some goats. Use something for shelter, but it wasn't like a city anymore.
It seemed like it had to be right after because the people were starving. So there were a lot of people starving. So
yeah, those scenes
were.
Those scenes were still vivid in here, weren't they? Terrible time for Jeremiah and for Israel.
Didn't you say there were three parts of the captivity?
There were three different times that people were taken captive from Jerusalem.
And Judah. Thing is 70 years.
Well, I think they start counting those 70 years. Well, from Zedekiah being taken, the last one. Even though he's not considered in the king's list, he doesn't have any descendants. I have to go drop back to Jehoiachin, who was taken in the second captivity. Okay, what prophet is next? Joel, that's an interesting one. What kind of notes you got for that, Jimmy? Who has Jimmy's paper? Jason and Token left their papers at home. Sorry.
I had some different thoughts, but I couldn't really say anything. I really didn't know. I know a lot of us talking about Jesus' time and the Holy Ghost coming.
Well, it's certainly prophecy about the New Testament in there.
John in Joel chapter 3, is he still prophesying? Behold, in those days of that time when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem.
Chapter 3, verse 1 has something to do with time. Let's start in chapter 1. Start in chapter 1. Joel is prophesying to whom? That's important. In verse 2, hear this, ye old men, and give ear, all ye inhabitants of the land. Now, the land is always the promised land, just like the people are always the Israelites. So there are old men in the land still. And asking them, has this been in your days, even the days of your fathers? They're having a famine, some kind of unusual event. Verse 4, that which the palmer worm hath left hath the locust eaten, and that which the locust has eaten, the cankerworm has eaten. Do you ever remember anything like that? We don't, but Joel's asking the old men. Do you ever remember hearing anything this bad? So God's getting serious with them. There are drunkards in the land, verse 5. And mourn because of the new wine. It's cut off from your mouth, meaning that there's so much famine they don't even get any grapes. They can't make new wine. Verse 9. Another result of this famine is that the house of God isn't receiving any meat offerings or food offerings or drink offerings. So the temple is still there. The field is wasted. The land mourns. The husbandmen are still in the land. In verse 11, vine dressers. Joy is withered away from the sons of men at the end of verse 12. A nation has come up upon my land, strong without number, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he has the cheek teeth of a great lion. He hath laid my vine waste and barked it, barked my fig tree, barked, you know, cut the bark off the fig tree so it died, so they wouldn't get any figs.
Are you saying that the tabernacle?
Tabernacle or temple?
Temple.
I would say.
The offerings?
Yeah. The meat offering and drink offering is cut off from the house of the Lord, and the priests mourn. That means they're not getting, they're having to go find their own way to make a living.
Weren't they making offerings in Jesus' time?
Yeah. You think Joel's in Jesus' time?
No.
We want to keep it reasonable. We don't want to be like, well, they, you know, they're prophets. Everything's in the future. Don't want to drift off into that.
I'm just trying to think of, for them to do an offering, they had to have a place to offer.
Right. But they didn't have anything to offer. That's the point of the whole chapter 1, is that they don't have any fields. They don't have any vines. They don't have any fig trees. They don't have anything to bring to the house. It's not that the house is gone. It's that what should be brought there is gone. See, it's talking to the priest, come mourn because the meat offering and drink offering is withholden from the house of your God. It's not like the house of God is not there and you've got all this stuff to bring and nowhere to bring it. It's just the opposite.
During the days of Manasseh, they had the temple closed, though, so they couldn't do it. If you had an offering.
Was it Manasseh or Ahaz?
So Manasseh shut the door to the temple of word.
Ahaz, Hezekiah's father. Nailed the door
shut.
Yeah. What do you think? Well, look at verse 14. Sanctify ye a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather your elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord your God and cry unto the Lord. The house is there.
Well, where did you read about the lion that's come up?
In verse 6.
So that would mean that Babylon had already, that was tell about Babylon?
Yeah, that's a possibility. Also, Assyria's possibility. Assyria took everything except Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem.
Yeah, so when I read that, I said, okay, that's already happened.
Yeah. What, Bob?
So you're saying that this has to be before the captivity? Because the house of the Lord is still there?
No, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying the house is there, which is obvious. He's calling for the people to gather into the house. Now, let's start. Who was the first king of the southern kingdom?
Rehoboam.
Who was the second one? Right, Abijam. Who was the third one? And our favorite character? Yeah, jumping Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram, a rotten guy. Yuck, I really like him. Then Ahaziah. And then Ahaziah was killed by Jehu in the north. The same day he killed the northern king. His little baby hid in the temple. You remember his name? Joash.
All I can think about is that you're doing this test in memory.
So name the first seven kings. Man, I was doing well too. Where are we? Amaziah is next. Is that right? Really?
Oh.
And after Amaziah, Amy, Uzziah. Uzziah is the one that went into the temple, you know, and got cursed by God. Uzziah and then Jotham. And then, is it Hezekiah? No. Ahaz. Yeah, he's a bad guy too. Then Hezekiah. And then Manasseh. Yeah, that's right. Manasseh was the worst one. And then Ammon was just 2 years. They assassinated him. Then you have Josiah. And then Eliakim, what was his other name? Jehoiakim, and then his son Jehoiachin, yeah. And then before Zedekiah, what was that other guy's name? Huh? No, this guy right here. Another J, isn't it? Wasn't there another one?
We had Jehoiachin. Jehoahaz,
yeah, the Egyptians took him. Okay, so that's got to be, I hope that's 19, because that's how many I had, but I'm not going to count. Jeremiah. Let's say Lamentations was written after this. Now we're talking about Joel. Let's compare it with the kings. I will not ask you anything like this on the test. Well, I won't say anything like that. Yeah, all the odd-numbered kings. No, that won't be anything like that. So let's say there are two possibilities for Joel. Either Solomon's temple or the one that they rebuilt when they came into the land. It has to be, because the house is there. It cannot possibly be during the captivity. There was no house of God. So that narrows it right on down.
Hey, John, it couldn't have been after they rebuilt it somewhere.
That's what we said. Either after they rebuilt it or before. Okay? Yeah.
What were the Assyrians?
A leopard. I think Babylon was called the lion with the great teeth, with the eagle's wings. Yeah. Okay.
Did verse 1-3 give you a hint of talking like three generations?
Well, that's in verse 2. Has this been in your days or even the days of your fathers? Can you think of any generations? Now, I think Gary has a pretty good point. Tell your children of it. Well, I don't know. and your children, let your children tell their children and their children another generation. They could do that anywhere. They could do that in captivity or out of captivity if they had children. So, nah, I don't think so. I don't think they can tell us anything about time.
So it probably couldn't have been Solomon's temple, then, if it's so your father's.
Why?
You old men give in all your habits of life.
You don't think there were old men when Solomon was around?
Yeah, have this been in your days or even in the days of your 12?
Yep.
Are we stuck on chapter 1 or can we go to chapter 2?
We're getting ready to move right on to chapter 2 right now. You'll be the first to know. Chapter 2. Blow ye the trumpet in Zion. There were priests in Zion. They are in Canaan's land. We know that. And the temple is there. Sound an alarm in my holy mountain and let the inhabitants of the land tremble. For the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh at hand. Now, hold on a second here. No, let's don't hold on a second. A day of darkness and of gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, as the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and strong, there hath not been ever the like. Neither shall any more after it, even into the years of many generations. And it describes the invaders of the land. Sounds like he's prophesying about something in Revelation, especially when you get down to verse 10. The earth shall quake before them, the heavens shall tremble, the sun and moon shall be dark, the stars shall withdraw their shining. But they had a lot of Old Testament representations of the New Testament. Even that one about speaking in tongues in Isaiah 28. For with stammering lips and another tongue will I speak to this people. He was referring to the Babylonians coming into the land. But that was just a symbol of the real fulfillment that Paul mentioned. And Paul mentioned it as being speaking in tongues, referring to speaking in tongues when you receive the Holy Ghost. So they can have an Old Testament meaning and a New Testament meaning. It was really fulfilled. So that's obviously something out of Revelation. If you read where those creatures are sent and how they destroy people and the sun turning dark and all that, that sounds an awful lot like Revelation. But it might also have an Old Testament fulfillment, but we don't know what. If there is an Old Testament fulfillment, then I would have to go before Babylon came and did all that to them. Because there's none like that afterward until Rome. What, Barbara?
Verse 1, blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain, let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. For the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh at hand. Couldn't that day of the Lord be the day that Jerusalem was destroyed?
Sure.
And it's nigh at hand. That's not what I'm talking
about. So, yeah, it seems like part of a last warning before something, but we're not to chapter 3 yet, Bob. The altar's there, the temple's there, people are in the land, and there's a warning about the day of the Lord is very close.
In verse 17, let the priests and ministers of the Lord weep before the porch and the altar. That sounds like it could be Solomon's temple.
Yeah, it does. Porch and the altar, between those two. Let's read 12 and 13. I love those things. Hold on. Okay, 10. When it's coming close for the time of the Lord to come. Yeah. That's what it sounds like. And verse 11, God's uttering His voice before His army. So God's sending that army, whatever it is, against His land. That's part of the day of the Lord. Verse 12, therefore, because God is going to do this, this is God's army coming. Therefore also now, saith the Lord, turn ye even unto me with all your heart, and with fasting, and with weeping, and with mourning, and rend your heart and not your garments. They could do the symbolic garment tearing thing and have nothing going on inside, but God wants them to tear their hearts like that. And turn unto the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and repenteth him of evil. And who knoweth if he will return, if he would change and repent, and leave a blessing behind him, so that we can bring a meat offering and a drink offering to the house of our God. Sounds as if God's going to destroy this place unless they repent. And we don't get any prophecies like that after they return to the land, that I know of. But here we go. We haven't gotten to chapter 3 yet. There's still hope.
Well, in verse 20, it sounds like if they will do that, he will remove far from them the northern army.
The northern army?
Yeah, that's a big thing.
What is the northern army, Earl? In Isaiah, what is the army from the north? In Jeremiah, what's the army from the north? Well, in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the northern army is always referring to Babylon. Because they're not called the eastern army, because they had to go up here and come down from the north. And Riblah, up here around Lebanon, northern Lebanon, Syria, was where Nebuchadnezzar sat up in the north while his army marched south and destroyed Jerusalem and brought Zedekiah up to him for judgment.
Could have been a number of northern armies.
Could have been 1,000 of them.
Everybody would have pretty much had to come from the north except the city.
That's right. Unless they were Greeks, they could have come from the west. By ship. The Philistines did. They were called sea peoples. There's still hope. Let's see, what else?
I always thought the northern army was Assyria.
Babylon's called the northern army much more than the Assyrians are. But they both came down from the north. But God is offering them a chance to escape. Verse 20, I will remove far off from you the northern army and drive him into a land barren and desolate, with his face toward the east sea and his hinder parts toward the utmost sea. That's the great sea, the utmost sea. East sea is the salt sea. All right. Anything else in chapter 2? Of course, 2:28 is what Peter mentioned on the day of Pentecost. This is that which the prophet Joel spake. Go ahead.
In verse 3 it says, if the land is as the garden of Eden before them.
Right.
And behind them a desolate wilderness. Well, in verse 4 of chapter 1 it said that the cankerworm and the pomegranate and the calico eating all that stuff, I don't think they'd have left the garden leading behind. So could be talking about more than one
nation involved. You know, God turned all the nations over to Assyria and then all of them over to Babylon so they could march through and destroy everything on their way.
Right. Before the captivity of Judah wasn't in Eden.
No, not at all. You know, Jimmy and I were talking about this yesterday. When we were over there, it's difficult to imagine that place ever being like the Garden of Eden. It's a wasteland in the summer. I'm telling you, if you like, Gary Savelli told me one time his favorite color was gray. He'd love Israel. I'm telling you, dusty, gray, rocky, barren. You don't even see a bird flying in the air, and that's not an exaggeration, is it? We went for days and never saw the first animal.
Most of them we saw was buried on top of the ground and
graves there.
It's
bad over there. It's difficult to imagine it ever being a land of milk and honey. There were some good spots over in the territory of northern Philistia where Dan's area was. Best soil I remember seeing over there around Gezer. It's funny, we were over there and all of us talking about how we were all old Gezers at Gezer. But anyway, it was a horrible place, it looked like. They had irrigation, and where they had irrigation was bright green, everything lush. But without that irrigation, there couldn't anything that I know of grow.
And he talked in there, he said, you're going to a land that never has to be irrigated like in Egypt. And
yeah.
All that land flowing with honey and watered all the time and everything. I don't know if it just changed.
It had to change if that was the case, because it was not like that. Of course, we went during the middle of the dry season. There, I got some pictures of some cattle up there and some like straw grass kind of thing. I don't remember it being real green. I don't remember anything being real green. Nothing. Except where it was irrigated, or a spring would come out of the ground on the side of a mountain somewhere, you'd see some green. It must have changed, because it at least in the summertime, it's barren. Now, they talk about the former and the latter rains and how they depended on them. When there was famine in the land, all that would have to mean is that they didn't get some former rains, or which is a spring, winter, or you know, whatever times of year, spring, fall, rains. If one of them failed, it'd be awful. It'd be awful. And when Joseph was in Egypt for 7 years, it's difficult to imagine. Or when Elijah stopped the rain for 3.5 years, it's hard to imagine how bad things could get there in a hurry. Because you dry out in that sun. You dry out. Fast. The land of milk and honey is just difficult to imagine. All those lines that you see on the map for all those rivers, they're empty in the summertime. Most of them that we saw, Jabbok's not empty.
The thicker ones on that map maybe have water in them.
Yeah, this would have water in it, Jabbok River, and the Yarmouk up there, that big one, that's a big one up here. And Beersheba, this is dry as a bone. It's nothing. But we walked in these, where the river is. There's nothing. Nothing. I'm telling you, it's dry rock. Nothing. And it hasn't been anything. It wasn't anything in there for a long time before we got there. So these aren't rivers like we know. They're only rivers during the rainy seasons.
So now it's not a flat, you know, Abraham planted a grove in Beersheba, but it's not, you couldn't plant a grove there now, could you?
Not unless you dug a well and your servants irrigated it or something. It's just dusty. It's difficult to describe how bad it is when we went there.
What about the Arnon River? Did it have water
there? We couldn't go over there, but I'm sure it does. I mean, it's the big one here. Drains these hills over here. But we could, if we'd had some strong binoculars over here at En Gedi, we might have been able to pick it out. I couldn't.
It seemed like not significant about digging wells all before we studied, so it sounds like it was kind of
yeah. It's just hard to imagine, though. God told them on the way there that it's not like Egypt where you had to water it with your foot with those pumps, turning wheels, bringing water out of the Nile River. Egypt, well, we don't have it. Yeah, Egypt, like 98% sand. This Nile River is its life. So they have to depend on irrigation.
Could you see across the Jordan?
Yeah, you could see there. It's surprising how small an area this whole thing is, really. About the size of Vermont. You get places fast. Surprisingly fast. So we could see across and see the hills. We went up to Bashan because Israel had taken that from Syria back in 67 or so. Or 73, whenever it was. And you could see across there, that valley easily, see the hills over there.
Actually, well, right there coming out of that sea there wasn't about half the distance of this room. Remember that one bridge when we come out of it?
Yeah, you're talking about right coming out of the Sea of Chinnereth? The Jordan River there, it's a creek. And it's an even smaller creek above there. So we're not talking about big areas here or a lot of water.
Where they crossed over, is that bigger?
Here? We never went down to this area. We went here, but we never took those border roads down that way. I guess you could if you were in a party in a bus going to be baptized or something. We just didn't do it. We decided to go into the salt sea and float around a little while.
John, isn't it like 25 to 30 miles? Is that what you said before? From the salt sea to the Sea of Chinnereth?
I can't remember. Seems like it ought to be, well, that may be right.
It's about 200 miles from the one end up to the other.
Yeah, 175, 200.
250 something from the way up the top all the way down.
It may be a little more than 30 miles. I really can't remember. Your book would tell you, your map book would tell you the distances.
25 miles from Jerusalem.
Maybe 50.
To the Salt Sea.
25 miles from Jerusalem to the Salt Sea, remember that?
We coasted right from that one red light, right in the middle, just as we was going over the hill. And then we started over the hill, I just let the motor run. We coasted 25 miles.
This right here is the lowest spot on the earth, outside the bottom of the oceans, the Salt Sea. So you can coast all the way from Jerusalem down here. You got to use your brake. You got to have good brakes, though.
It looks like it's about 100 miles.
100 miles from one end to the other?
Yeah.
Well, from one sea to the other?
1 inch equals 10 miles, and that's probably about...
That's 7. At 80 miles.
Well, I figured I got a crease here.
Nah, it's not going to be that much.
That's a complete end.
Probably about 70 miles, my guess. 75, maybe. So... Well, that's a description of the land. Well, when did Joel live? As a matter of fact, just talking about coasting, Jimmy, we coasted from Mount Hermon down to where we were staying at the southern end of the Salt Sea, of the Chinnereth Sea. Our transmission went out. We had first gear and what, fourth or something, first and fifth or something. We had to work it, just let it go. Down the hill. Bob, we're in chapter 3 now. Take it away.
For behold, in those days and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem.
So, how could that be after the captivity, when they had already been called back? I mean,
before?
How could that be after they have come back from captivity and built the house?
When I shall bring again.
Yeah, bring them back. Bring again doesn't mean he's brought a captivity one time and he's going to do it again. It's just an odd way of King James translating the Hebrew. It means that when I bring the captives again to their land.
So we're looking at during the time when they were in the land, and we're looking at a time when they weren't in the land.
Well, this is a prophecy of when God is going to bring them back to the land. But they're in the land now.
Okay, prophesy what's going
to happen. I took that again as that the captivity has already happened. And he's saying, are we going to do this again?
Nah.
Are we going to repeat the captivity?
Yeah, that's not what that word. That's a confusing translation there. It's not a repeat captivity. Mm-hmm. When he restores them to their land, basically is all it means. In verse 4, Tyre and Sidon have not been destroyed yet.
In verse 2, he refers to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, so it had to have been after Jehoshaphat or it wouldn't call the Valley of Jehoshaphat.
That's right. Had to be after the time of Jehoshaphat. Valley of Jehoshaphat is probably when he let the Levites and the singers go ahead of the army and went down and fought here. Let me see. In this Valley of Blessing. I didn't fight. Just went and picked up the goods. The attackers fell on each other. And he's condemning Tyre and Sidon because of verse 6, selling the children of Judah and Jerusalem to the Grecians. So they were known then. Because the Grecian history goes back maybe 1,000 years before Jesus, down to David. David's 1,000 years before Jesus.
Tyre was a seaport.
Right. So they were sailing off with Jewish slaves that they had bought, and they were selling them into the hands of the Greeks.
Verse 19,
Egypt shall be a desolation. Edom shall be a desolate wilderness for the violence against the children of Judah, because they have shed innocent blood, and Judah shall dwell forever in Jerusalem from generation to generation.
Were those two places in desolation prior to the fall of Jerusalem?
No. Babylon and Babylon would have come here first and then there. They would have passed through Judah to get to Egypt and Edom, unless they wanted to circle them.
What was the violence against Judah by Edom?
Well, they had several, beginning with Jehoram, Hezekiah's rotten son. He did so badly that Edom and Ammon and all the Philistines, all of them started attacking Judah. And Who was it that was king when it said the Edomites rebelled against Israel from that day forward? It was one of the kings in the north that had dominion over them at that time. So there was a lot of violence all the way through times of it. Amaziah went and fought against the Edomites for some reason. Where is he? He's way on up here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8th king out of 19. He was fighting against the Edomites. Remember, he defeated them and then brought their gods home and started worshiping them? That's a good question for a test. Huh? Go ahead.
Did Saul fight against them all the way back in his time?
Who? Saul. Yeah. So there was always conflict with the Edomites.
It was King Ahaz's time when they came over and took captives, right?
Edom? Well, it might have been. There are several times when they came. One was right after, well, right near the end of Jehoram's reign. Jehoshaphat's rotten son. So at least starting then, probably before, I know Saul fought against them. David fought against them and won.
What about midway through chapter 2, verse 17? Spare thy people, O Lord, and give not thine heritage to reproach, that the heathen should rule over them. Wherefore should they say among the people, where is their God?
I've got that marked. That's a good point, Amanda. Spare your people so the heathen won't rule over them. So it's a time when the heathen aren't ruling over them. And after the time of... from the time of Jehoahaz, immediately after Josiah dies, until 1948, the Jews lived under the domination of some kind of Gentile government. In their own land, they stayed under foreign domination, either of the Babylonians or the Medes and Persians with Esther. You saw that with Ezra and Nehemiah. Or the Greeks next. Or the Romans. In about 140 A.D., the Romans made it a capital offense for any Jew to be caught in the land. They got so disgusted with them, they kicked them out and said, if any Jew comes in that territory, we'll kill him.
After the captivity, and you had Nehemiah and everybody coming back, and they rebuilt Jerusalem. Jerusalem would have still been under Babylonian rule. Is that correct?
No, that was Persia, Medo-Persian. Medo-Persia, the king of Persia is the one that sent them back.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. So they would have been paying taxes to the Persian government.
They never were free again. They were even kicked out of their own country, and wherever they went, they didn't have their own country. So from this time, from Josiah until 1948, the Israelites were under Gentile rule. So if this, as Amanda pointed out in 2:17, if there's a prayer, God spare your people from being under foreign rule, it has to be sometime before Jehoahaz, when Egyptian king took over there. And then Babylon next.
That sounds like your best verse.
Yeah, that's an excellent one. Thank you, Amanda, for pointing that out. So Joel, I would think, maybe during Jeremiah's time and Josiah's day. Didn't Jeremiah mention a famine? He said the farmers go outside and they're very disappointed. The animals dying. My best bet for Joel is right here. Or sometime in Ahaz's day, maybe here, before the foreign Assyrians come, but I think that's less likely. Sounds more like what Jeremiah talked about. Well, that would be during Josiah's time, Jeremiah. Sometime right in there. But we're just going by what you know about the Old Testament. And if you want to know the truth about it, that's all you can trust. You cannot trust commentaries. You cannot trust what the experts know, because the experts know nothing more than you know. This is the information. They may know some Assyrian legends or Babylonian legends or such, but you can't trust that. The Egyptians purposely changed history. They were proud of it. If there was a pharaoh that came on the throne that didn't like a particular previous pharaoh, he would have his names erased and his deeds and records of him erased, chiseled off rocks, so there'd be no mention of him ever again in any historical record. So you can't trust those ancient sources except God. You've got all the information that any expert can use that's trustworthy. So you need not be impressed with the pronouncements of the experts. You're the expert if you are expert on the Old Testament. All our reasoning makes sense? Sorry, Bob, that verse kind of threw you off there, that again word.
Well, so that was a prophecy.
I would think so.
Yeah. It's just interesting that he would use the term captivity of Judah and Jerusalem.
Well, I believe Isaiah and Jeremiah did the same thing. I believe they spoke of the captivity of God's people. When I'm going to return, the return of the captives or such as that. Let me look up here and see if I can't find you an example. Let's look up captivity first. My goodness, it's in Jeremiah 20 times. Thine house shall go into captivity. Your lovers shall go into captivity. I will turn away your captivity. I don't know. Just
God was letting them know it was on the way.
In Psalms, it talks about we hang our harps in Babylon. Hundreds of years before it happens. Isaiah talks about they shall take them captive. He shall let go. In Isaiah 40, what is it? He even names Cyrus and says, he's my servant. He's going to send my captives home. It's right at the end of one chapter and the beginning of the next. Isaiah. Let's look at it. I'll show you. It'll be easy to find. It's right at the end of Isaiah 40-something. 44. Right at the end of Isaiah 44. Talking about how great God is that says this and does that. In the last verse of chapter 44 in Isaiah, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. Now Cyrus is the one in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1, that said, whoever is left of these Israelites, go home, build the temple. God has commanded for you to do that. And shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Look at this. It goes on. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before. When you loose the loins of kings, it's because they're shaking so much that their robes fall apart, like the king's knees knocking together. That's how afraid of him they're going to be. To open before him the two leaved gates. They just surrender. And the gates shall not be shut. I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron. And this is the next two verses I wanted to get to. I will give you the treasures of darkness and hidden riches and of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, Jehovah, which call you by your name. This is hundreds and hundreds of years before he's born. Am the God of Israel. For Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee. I have named you, though you have not known me. So they had prophecies about returning from captivity a long time before they went into captivity.
Do you think that obviously that would have been a writing that Cyrus may have even known about?
Sure. Somebody Ezra may have told him about it. Nehemiah. They were in high, they had a lot of respect with that king. He probably knew about that.
Maybe that's why he was so agreeable to sending people back.
Might have been, might have had a part of it. He said, God has told me to do it. Well, that certainly would have meant something to him, because he would have been able to know if they were trying to trick him. He would have known they were ancient writings. Well, hundreds of years old at his time. He would have known that they were telling, Ezra was telling the truth. He had ways to check, find out.
Is there any other prophecy like that where names are actually given?
I'm trying to think. Well, Josiah.
Josiah.
That was 300 years earlier. Anything else? What?
According to Joe, it looks like Babylon had come in his time, right?
Not to me.
The northern army and the lions still come around?
Well, that sounds like more of a prophecy to me than it does anything else. Because it's also a prophecy of things in Revelation. We went through that, chapter 2. But Babylon came into the land three different times, at least. Actually, four. But this is before Babylon came with the final blow.
Did they destroy all the cities in Canaan's land?
Who?
The Babylonians.
They wouldn't have destroyed them all.
Well, I mean like Tyre and
Sidon. Well, I don't know that they're in Canaan's land. That where the Israelites lived. They were in the land of Canaan in Genesis 10, but the Israelites didn't have it. Sidon is one of Canaan's sons.
Oh, you know who the Sabaeans are?
Yeah, but Tyre and Sidon, they would have destroyed them. Especially Tyre, it's told about. What?
You know who the Sabaeans are?
They're kind of traveling merchant people. Well, they probably had caravans. Okay, anything else? What?
Did the Tyre and Sidon sell in them six, the children also of Judah and the children of Jerusalem, have you sold them to the Grecians?
Yeah.
There's
been slave trade from the beginning, practically. Okay, what's next? Obadiah is easy, right?
I thought Joel was easy.
Obadiah is kind of like Lamentations. It's kind of obvious. What did you have for Obadiah, Aaron? Sometime after, that means 1936, or?
I have right here, after Judah.
Well, that's 1936, right? Right before Hitler?
So soon after Judah's taken captive.
Soon after. How soon after? What do you think, Amy? You don't have your paper. Boy, old Jason and Token. I bet they got their papers. What do you got, Jason?
Yeah. After it was burned and taken captive, but before the 70 years of captivity was finished. But I'd say it was closer to the beginning.
Closer to the beginning of what?
Of the 70 years of captivity.
Is that what you got, Taylor? What do you have?
I've got after the destruction of Judah and during or possibly after the captivity.
After the captivity? Why?
I said possibly.
Why do you think it's possible, though?
I had a reason, because I didn't write that verbiage for any other book. I just have to remember why.
You didn't write down a note for that?
Well, I wrote down the one verse.
What's that? What verse is it?
Chapter 1, verse 11 and 12.
Chapter 1, verse 11 and 12, and that's what makes you think it possibly could be after the captivity? Obadiah chapter, well, there's not but one chapter. Verse what?
11 and 12.
In the day that thou stoodest on the other side of what? Might have been the Jordan River. In the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, Israel's forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and then cast lots upon Jerusalem, who would be able to sack what part of the city? How are his hidden things sought up? All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee, that they eat thy bread They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee, and there's no understanding in him. That's Edom. So what about that seems after the captivity?
I seem to remember thinking that it was a short enough chapter and there was nothing in there that led me to think it could not be after the captivity. There's nothing that told me that it couldn't be. So I said possibly after.
Is there anything it would lead you to think that it could possibly be before the captivity?
No, because I wouldn't have written possibly after.
So you think it's in the captivity?
No. It could possibly be after, because I didn't see anything that would let me think that that wasn't a possibility. There's nothing in the chapter that led me think it had to be during, if it was after the destruction of Judah.
What about verse 20?
Verse 20, and the captivity of the host of the children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath, and the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. Now when it says the captivity, it means the captives, the people in captivity. So the people that are in captivity of this army of the children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites. Even all the way to Zarephath. And the ones in captivity that came from Jerusalem in the south, which are in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. Bob, would you like to...
Well, they haven't possessed them yet. Come back, those are the places they're going to have. So they haven't come back yet. So it can't be after the 70 years, for they haven't returned from captivity yet.
What do you think?
That would be gotta be before or during captivity. The other one had you after the destruction of Israel.
I think verses 12 and 13, 14, they're all talking about how Esau treated the Israelites when they were trying to escape from Babylon's destruction, is what it sounded like to me. When they're trying to escape from a destruction. Esau didn't just not help. They helped the Babylonians.
Yeah, they came in and took what was left.
They took what's left, and they also captured runaway Israelites that had escaped from Babylonia, had escaped from the Babylonian army, and turned them back over. So that had to be that event. Turning them back over to the Babylonian army had to be days or weeks after the city was destroyed, that part. Obadiah could have been prophesying after that and saying, you shouldn't have done that. But how long exactly after Edom had treated the Israelites that way that he spoke, we don't know. But we do know that is before they returned from captivity because of verse 20. Yeah, but upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. There are a lot of clues in here when you really think about it, right? A lot of clues in here. So let's put, we're running out of room down here at the bottom.
Is there anything in the history that tells when the Babylonians took over? Moab, Ammon, or Edom? Is there anything in history books that tells the Babylonians took over Moab, Ammon, or Edom? Didn't they take that whole area eventually? I mean, after the Jews. Because verse 15 says, for in the day of the Lord, is near upon all the heathen, as thou hast done, it shall be
blessed thee.
It shall return
from thine own head. Well, God said through Daniel and Jeremiah that he was going to give all those nations to Nebuchadnezzar. So that was foretold.
It seems like after, so I
would put Obadiah somewhere in this area, wouldn't you? After the destruction of the temple, but during the captivity. And then you have the return. Obadiah's in there sometime. Lamentations is right here after the destruction. Obadiah is there. We kind of think Joel probably was working right along with Jeremiah, or thereabouts. So we're doing well. No problems.
So you're saying during the 70 years in
I would think early on during those 70 years, but I don't know. It was definitely during the 70 years because they hadn't come back yet, according to verse 20.
The first part of verse 12
says what?
But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother in the day that he became a stranger.
Well, see, that's that right there.
Yeah. Okay.
That's when they became strangers. That is the beginning part of the captivity. The destruction of Jerusalem, the temple. You know, the 70 years probably began, according to Jeremiah, probably began when Jehoiachin was taken captive, which was the second of the three captivities before the city was destroyed, because the Jeremiah wrote to captives who were already in Babylon saying, it's going to be 70 years. Just hold on. So yeah, the 70-year captivity may have begun with Jehoiachin instead of Zedekiah. Okay, what's next book? We're doing great. All right, Chris, what you got for Nahum? After Assyria had destroyed Israel. Let me see. Let me write on here the captivity of the northern kingdom, which happened in Hezekiah's ninth year. Israel captive. And see, I remembered his ninth year. That might be on the test. No. I wouldn't do that to you. It's all right. So she's saying, after Israel is taken captive. What do you got, Randall?
Well, I put before Nineveh was destroyed by Babylon, in captivity.
Sometime before, well, we know that it was sometime before Nineveh was destroyed by Babylon, right? And that happened sometime during Josiah's lifetime, probably, because the Egyptians were on their way up to finish off Assyria. And killed Josiah on the way up there. So before Nineveh is destroyed is probably somewhere around in here, Nineveh. Here's where Israel is taken captive. Chris says it's after that. Randall says it's before. Chris says it's after the ninth year of Hezekiah. Randall says it's before the end of, before Jehoiakim becomes king. So we got a block of time in here. Anything in there that contradict that? What does verse 13 mean? I will break his yoke from off thee and will burst thy bonds in sunder. The Assyrians were really very cruel. The Babylonians preserved the cultures where they went. They were friendly to cultures. Same way with the Medes and the Persians. They didn't try to obliterate people and their culture. The Assyrians would completely disrupt one people and put them in another land, and they'd have to learn the ways of that god and that land. It would just break everything apart. The Assyrians were very destructive. They were known for skinning people alive and hanging them up on the sides of walls, and it was just awful. Of course, the Babylonians did some bad things, but they weren't. Inside themselves, they weren't trying to force their gods and their ways and their culture on the whole world. They would allow you to worship your god and your culture as long as you sent your tax money in and obeyed the commandments of the king. He's promising in that verse and all the way through that Nineveh is in for it. But why does it have to be after Israel is destroyed? What do you think, Barbara? Oh, I'm sorry.
What about 2:2? For the Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob, as the excellency of Israel, the emperors have emptied them out and marred their vine branches. That's like a prophecy of both of them.
Read it again, chapter 2, verse 2.
For the Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob, as the excellency of Israel. For the emperors have emptied them out and marred their vine branches. That made me think it was a prophecy of both of them.
A prophecy of both the North and the South Kingdom?
Yeah. But I don't confuse
Israel.
Yeah, but that's the first thing I thought when I read that.
Jacob could, when it's comparing Jacob and Israel, sometimes it's talking about North and South. Read it again. Go ahead, Bob.
For the Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob, as the excellency of Israel, for the emperor.
As he has done to the excellency of Israel. That's what I get out of that.
Yeah. You think he's just rephrasing that?
What does your perversion say, Mark?
The Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel, though destroyers have laid them waste and have ruined their vines.
Read it again.
The Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel, for the emptiers have emptied them out and marred their vine branches.
What do you think, Lynn? You see anything in there to contradict what Chris said?
I'm looking at 1:15 where it says, O Judah, keep thy solemn feast and perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee.
Taylor?
I didn't hear what that says.
She's reading 1:15. She changed the subject. Clever woman. It's a prophecy about Assyria, and the whole book's about Assyria.
But has Judah been taken also?
No. Assyria never did take Judah, but it sure did take everything except that one little spot right there called Jerusalem. Remember Hosea prophesied that the river would come and cover the land and go up to the neck?
Yeah.
And I explained to you that the head of the whole country was Jerusalem, and he had them surrounded, had everything except Jerusalem. That's what Hosea was saying. So Assyria did destroy Israel and plunder Judah. And that's what it seems, that's what Nahum seems to be referring to in chapter 2, verse 2 that Barbara mentioned.
Doesn't mean he's taken it.
Well, he plundered the whole country of Judah in the south and destroyed Israel in the north. In verse 12, he tore them to pieces.
It says a
man to
tear them
pieces.
Yeah. 3:10 says that he's 3:10, yet she was
carried out to
captivity.
It's talking about Judah in verse 8.
Where you still had the king of Assyria.
Mm-hmm.
So that it had to be during when Assyria was in power.
Had to be.
Mm-hmm. I said second king.
So let's put Nahum. In the ninth year Israel was taken captive, the Assyrians come right on down to Judah, and God wipes them out. Jerusalem is delivered. And from that time on, the Assyrian kingdom goes down. So let's put him, So let's put Nahum sometime in here. Late Hezekiah, maybe. Early Manasseh days. Manasseh would have killed somebody like Nahum as a true prophet. So if he lived during Manasseh's days, he wouldn't have been real bold. And he wouldn't have prophesied against Judah and lived very long.
What is that? You said Jerusalem.
Is delivered. You know what the Assyrians, what God did to them. Now, Elijah, what do you got?
I don't really know how to grade it because I said when Babylon began conquering, an end of Assyria.
Well, that's close enough. Hey, we're doing well. Uh-oh. Here comes a fly in the ointment. I can smell it.
Quick question for you. Zephaniah also prophesied about Babylon, didn't he?
I don't know, did he?
The destruction of 2:13, I think.
Well, let's read it and see. Don't tell me you think. You got it written down. Zephaniah 2:13. Is that right, 2:13? Zephaniah was prophesied during the days of Josiah. Zephaniah 2:13, the first verse or two will tell you he lived during the days of Josiah, king of Judah. All right, what does 2:13 say?
And he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria and will make Nineveh a desolation.
Yeah. So during Josiah's day, well, you know that the Assyrian power was not conquered until that Egyptian king killed Josiah on his way up there to do it. So the Assyrian power could be anywhere in here. Matter of fact, let's just stick Nahum somewhere in the middle of this time. Let's say Ammon, maybe, late Manasseh. Could be next to Joel. But it has to be before Assyrian power is destroyed. I don't think Nahum would have lived long under Manasseh's reign, though.
I'd say he's before or after.
Yeah. He might have been with Jeremiah early. Oh, I think we're doing a great job. And the best is yet to come, right?
Wasn't the Assyrian king killed shortly after his defeat at God destroyed his army?
He was assassinated, but his son Esarhaddon took his place, and he was pretty powerful too.
Right. But on verse 1:15.
Now listen to Billy.
Verse 1:15, it says...
Let me tell them what you already said. After God delivered Jerusalem, the Assyrian king's army down here in the south was wiped out. So he returned home to Assyria just as God said. When he was kneeling in the temple of his God, his two sons murdered him. But his son, another son, Esarhaddon, became king of Assyria, and he was very powerful. So that... Just because that Assyrian king was assassinated doesn't mean the Assyrian kingdom went down the tube yet.
At the end of verse 1:15.
In Nahum 1:15?
Yeah. God told Judah that the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off.
Yeah.
So that makes me think it may have been right after that king, either the army got destroyed or after the king had got his army got destroyed anyway, that fire got assassinated too.
It's a good point because they never made it back down there. So it was after Jerusalem's deliverance. And after that guy, maybe after that guy was killed.
That seems to be pretty well utterly.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't it say that they started getting weak?
It did. But Esarhaddon, but that was a power. I mean, that empire spread all the way from the Persian Gulf into Egypt. It took it, started going downhill. It stopped expanding and started shrinking. But still, he was still a powerful guy, Esarhaddon. That's Nahum. Who's next? What? Okay. Bob says, wait a minute. Turn to Habakkuk. Bob says, back up. Oh, yeah.